Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I am recording this intro by myself, as this is an intro for a podcast that's a bit different than our normal format, which is I've got four individual segments here, rather than having everybody on the phone or on their computer through Skype at the same time. I have just asked four of my friends to all talk about the same subject, and then I'm splicing them together, and I'm going to do little intros for each one at that point. Here's what I came up with. I know a lot of you realize that I inhabit what feels to me like a big Mormonism. It feels roomy enough for me. You know, certainly it's not perfect. There's things that drive me crazy. The week-to-week experience is not always ideal for, you know, me being fed, but yet, you know, somehow there's a state of grace that I sort of feel like I'm in, you know, where, you know, God's either granting me grace or that at least lets me somehow grant grace to those around me who, you know, disagree with me or take positions that I find hard or, you know, gosh, I wish it would be better or something like that. And it just works for me. And I know that you recognize that about me. And I just thought it would be good to kind of find some other friends of mine for whom Mormonism pretty much works similarly and just ask them the question, what is it that is your favorite thing of all things that you could talk to or think about Mormonism? You know, what compels you? What makes your mind soar? Just what is it about the culture? It could be anything that is kind of your favorite thing about Mormonism. And I was very, very surprised that of the four, only one picked something theological. The others were all more in the social category and things like that. And it was just fascinating to hear all four people and then the differentiation between the final three that I'm then putting on here. So I'm going to put my theological person first, and let me introduce her quickly to you. This is Lori Winder Stromberg. Lori is somebody I've known for 15, 20 years now. I got to know her from going to Sunstones, and then eventually as I led Sunstone and things like that, she was a regular, and we always called on her to be on panels or she would propose papers and things. She's just wonderful. But she is a longtime Mormon feminist, kind of an activist, a writer. In her long career, she has worked for lots of publications, including Sunstone and Exponent 2, the Mormon Women's Forum Quarterly. At one time, she was with the Journal of Modern History, which is based at the University of Chicago. She has also done lots of works on art programming. She's kind of in humanity councils, PTAs, just this active, active person, always kind of putting herself out front to make the world a better place. I just really admire her. But then I kind of guessed that she might go theological because she just has this really wonderful, deep, rich appreciation for subtle theological thought. And I'd known that about her, so it didn't totally surprise me what she came up with, but it really thrilled me. Let me introduce you to my segment with Lori Winder Stromberg, who's married to her husband Tom. They live in the L.A. area, right kind of downtown, right near the L.A. Temple. And they've been married for 32 years. They have two grown children. And here's Lori Winder Stromberg as our first guest. So, Lori, thank you for being on. I can't wait to hear what you've come up with.
Well, I thought that I'd read a bit from a presentation I did for a Catholic Mormon Dialogue on Women's Ordination.
Okay.
In 2012 at Claremont University.
So, and this contains kind of some of your favorite things or your favorite thing.
It does.
Okay.
It contains a few of the things that I find most compelling about Mormonism.
All right, let's try it.
Okay. Perhaps the most theologically promising avenue for women's empowerment is the presence of a Heavenly Mother in traditional Mormonism. Although trapped in a patriarchal paradigm, the Church has been reluctant to acknowledge women's attempts to move God the Mother out of the shadows of our theological discourse. Despite feminist efforts, for many Mormons, God the Mother remains God the Father's supportive wife perfected, silently plumping pillows and awaiting our return. And yet an empowered God the Mother seems more consonant with one of Mormonism's most intellectually and spiritually compelling teachings, namely the belief in a God who wants to share power and spiritual authority, whose desire is our empowerment. This flows out of the LDS belief that while our Heavenly Father and Mother are loving, perfected beings who gave birth, if you will, to our spirits, our essence, in Mormon terms, our intelligence, is uncreated and co-eternal with God, at least in pre-Madison Avenue Mormonism. The Mormon God is not the prime mover of traditional Christianity, but in the words of one Mormon writer, the most moved mover, empathy and love, if you will, deified. Because in Mormonism, our essential selves are uncreated, our choices have real and profound theological consequence. We become, in a sense, co-creators with God, not only as parents, but as moral agents, striving with God for a more just and equitable world. We are not mere instruments in God's hands, but co-actors with God. As such, we are radically responsible for our choice, either to perpetuate injustice by inaction or to embrace a moral activism that requires us to work for goodness, justice, mercy, and equality. Those who accuse Mormon women of being power-hungry if they advocate for women's ordination fail to recognize that in Mormonism, spiritual empowerment is the sum of God's hope for us as men and women. In this sense, wanting and accepting power is not a bad thing. There is no shame, nor are there accusations of improper ambition attached to a 12-year-old boy in the church who aspires to priesthood ordination. To be sure, power in institutions, including churches, can be wielded coercively and abusively. This is one reason women are leery of power, and Mormon scripture rightly warns about its ability to corrupt. However, having power within an institution is preferable to institutional powerlessness, and having power can enable us to do tremendous good, particularly if we use it, as we are told Jesus did, not to coerce, but to empower others.
Very nice. Done. Boy, that is rich. Lots of different things in there, but they're definitely all related. Would you say, so something, if you were to put it all into one sentence, it's more the idea that as co-eternal beings with God, the whole shebang is about us becoming more empowered and God wanting that for us. Something
right.
Like that? Okay.
Right. In one sentence, Mormons believe in a God who wants peers.
Nice. Yeah, that's one of my favorite ones. I don't think Joseph Smith said that, but yeah, that's definitely been a good phrase that's out there.
He didn't say that specifically.
Yeah.
But that's the implication of classical Mormonism, I think.
I agree. Yeah, especially when you go right to that bottom of the universe stuff is, I didn't create you. I simply am a model for you. I am a aspiring vision that you can attain to yourself if you choose it. Like you said, a lot of your stuff here was real choices, real consequences. We're co-actors with God. Hey, man,
right.
you have named stuff that's my favorites too. So, oh, man, thanks, Lori. I'm excited to keep going on this a little bit.
Yeah, you certainly have the theological and philosophical chops to talk, you know, speak about all of this stuff. My stuff is more impressionistic, I think. This isn't a theological paper. I mean, it is a theological paper, but it's more impressionistic than it is you know, point by point by point an argument. But it's what I find compelling about Mormonism. And quite frankly,
sure.
I think a lot of other people would find it compelling about Mormonism. It seems to me that some of these ideas are beliefs that we've sort of, in the church's attempt to appeal to evangelicals, Christians or traditional Christians, we've sort of pulled back from some of the
right.
things, it seems to me. I mean, is that your reading of it?
Totally, yeah. I don't know if you've listened to the podcast much, but we did one on theosis and one on the couplet, you know, with Lorenzo Snow mm-hmm. and the Becoming Like Gods mm-hmm. thing. And even there's one of them we did early on was called, you know, Towards Keeping Mormonism Weird. And it was my yeah. attempt to get a group saying, let's embrace all this stuff that isn't just
right.
typical stuff that is palatable to others. So I'm totally with you on that.
We were out with Frenzy, you know, a few months ago. He's former Mormon, has been inactive for a long time, and I had just really met his daughter on a couple of occasions. She was in her 20s, and we were talking, and I mentioned, you know, some of this stuff to her, and she found it compelling. I mean, this is a young woman who didn't grow up with Mormonism, didn't grow up with these beliefs, and for her it was just like an aha moment.
Nice. Yeah, I love it. You know, when I was at Claremont and I would throw kind of this stuff out on the table and say, well, here's a Mormon angle on this, here's a Mormon angle on this, their jaws would drop. They'd go, what are you talking about? Mormonism actually has interesting theological positions, you know, and they would love it. You know, oh, I just thought you guys were a bunch of conservative, you know, conformists, you know, rah-rah America, you know, kind of thing was their impression. And then you throw this kind of stuff out there and they just said, wow, keep telling us more. So this is the stuff that belongs at the table for sure.
Yeah, I think it does. And I think it's appealing.
Totally.
I think it would be really appealing to people if we talked about it in a more expansive way. I find myself going to church. This is maybe off topic and you can decide whether you want to leave this in or not, but I went to church on Wear Pants to Church Day and
uh-huh.
Sunday school, and the lesson was on the Proclamation of the Family. And I started thinking about even rethinking that document. And I started thinking about the idea that maybe we need to be a little more expansive in our thinking about a lot of issues. For example, even you know, the question I asked in class was, is the new tend to fetishize the family, and sometimes it's awfully hard on people who don't have the traditional family.
Right.
And maybe what we should be doing is thinking of the family less in terms as the unit of exaltation, and more in terms of a vehicle for exaltation, just like the church
nice.
Is a vehicle for exaltation and that sort of thing. That maybe we really need to learn is that exaltation is relational.
Totally. That is great. That is a great phrase. I am excited that you're dealing with this. Now, when you're at church and you were talking there about your own thoughts, do you find people pretty receptive? Like when you decide to, you know, hey, we're selling ourselves short. We have a much richer doctrine than perhaps is being shared in the lesson. Have you been able to successfully, you know, tell people, hey,
yeah,
you know, here's what, yeah, or here's what's compelling to me. And then how do they react at church?
It's mixed. I have people that come up to me afterward in whispers and say, thank you for saying that. I found that really compelling. And others will for the same comment, will go running to the bishop and report me for being disruptive.
No way. Oh, man.
I mean,
because,
it's bizarre. It's
clearly Mormon stuff. This is Mormon stuff. Is it the fact that you are bringing up Mother in Heaven and that's a trigger for them? Or is it this whole eternalism?
Well, I don't even talk about Mother in Heaven.
Huh.
You're just
talking about empowerment and being...
Sometimes
God wanting peers?
When I use this phrase, it was years ago, Mormons believe in a God who wants peers. I had several people come up saying they got chills when they heard that, and then I got other reports that people went running to the bishop saying I was teaching false doctrine. So who knows?
So let me go down my list. I was doing my best to kind of write stuff out as you were doing it. So you kind of started off with the early God the Mother framing, and you were basically saying, you know, the silently plumping pillows and waiting for our return, but yet it's clear that everything else in Mormonism screams that she's a full partner, that, you know, that God would share power and glory, you know, or the gods share power and glory with each other, you know, obviously
right.
this. And so I loved all that stuff. And even you talked about you took spiritual birth out of it in terms of, you know, reminding us that it's all uncreated stuff. And so whatever process it is, you're not imagining a heavenly mother who's pregnant all the time and actually,
no.
Yeah. So good. Yeah. So I love all that stuff, but yeah, but just everything that you said there, just with this means it, we're co-creating, where these are real choices, these are real consequences, we're radically responsible for doing good, for the justice and things like that. And so, oh man,
well, I find it I think it's a theological justification for moral, what I call moral activism.
Yes.
You know, that we aren't, you know, because we're uncreated, and you could probably say it better than I, because we are, there's something essential about us that is uncreated, I think it points to having real and profound theological consequence to our choices. We have choice, real choice. And, I mean, our experience and chemistry, body chemistry and everything else obviously influence how much choice we have. Some of us are probably freer than others, if you will. But our fact is, in Mormonism, our choices have really real and profound moral consequence.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
Don't you think Mormonism points to that?
I do, yeah. You know, but then the culture kind of takes over. Folks that, you know, either don't see the vision, or, you know, a lot of us just want to be told what to do, or we want to kind of give our choice over. I just had Fiona Givens as part of a panel, and she quoted something. I think she said it was from Dostoevsky, and it's like, so many humans want others to be the keepers of our conscience. You
oh,
know,
right.
There's this idea that... that we just, you know, don't want to really be a co-creator with God at this point. And I understand that. And so I know the church has to minister wherever the folks are. But, yeah, it's a shame to ever forget that we have these wonderfully huge radical doctrines. And, man, I just love everything that you said. It's interesting that you'd picked what I would have picked.
Right. And I think that we're really responsible for the quality of our doctrines and beliefs. We as members play a part in the whole process of revelation as well. I mean, I think that we have to do the asking. We have to state the need.
Yes.
And we can't sit it out.
Yeah.
We can't sit it out, you know, in terms of gender issues and gender equity issues, it just sort of floors me that we're increasingly as in Western culture, we accept the we refuse to accept gender inequality in our secular lives, right? We would, but we, you know, all too often embrace it in our religious lives.
Yes.
And I don't understand that. I don't, because I feel like we're moral agents and we're responsible for the quality of our community. We're responsible for how our beliefs and practices affect the broader community. And if there's gender inequity in our community, in our religious community, it impacts the people more than just the people inside the community. It makes room for other types of social injustice.
Yeah, that's a good point. If we understood the one more clearly, we'll understand all of them more clearly, and how they're all connected with this radical agency that we have and this responsibility as creators.
Well, it forces you to be moral activists.
Yeah,
I think, and I think that's the implication, that you can't, again, you can't just sit it out. You have to act.
Well, and acting you have done for so many years. I'm so thrilled to put your voice out in front of my listeners. Everybody, Lori Winder Stromberg, she has been writing and speaking and putting her body and her great intelligence to work all the time on this, and she's somebody I just really admire. So, Lori, I was so grateful to have you come on.
Thanks, Dan.
I'm excited to introduce my second guest to you. Those of you who've listened to the podcast a while, you may be aware that I had this fellow on once before. His name is Taylor Petrie. He wrote an amazing article toward a post-heterosexual Mormon theology in Dialogue in the winter of 2011, so issue 44, number 4. And I had him and Christine Haglund, the editor of Dialogue, come on and kind of talk about the issues there, and basically, can Mormonism at some time in the future affirm same-sex relationships? And it was a great discussion. But this guy is just one of my favorite dudes. He's just got this wonderful energy, this amazing mind, big breath. His doctorate's from Harvard, and he was there for lots of years, and he headed up the Mormon Students Association there. He is now an assistant professor at Kalamazoo College, which is in Michigan, Kalamazoo, Michigan. And he's also the director of the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Program, or whatever you would call it there. Anyway, these are issues that do, but is also his trainings in biblical studies and things like this. So I know that that's what he teaches mostly at the school, along with these gender and issues like that. So not the smoothest introduction I've ever given, but you're going to love this guy. So welcome to my segment with Taylor Petrie. Taylor, thanks for joining me. I'm so excited to have you here, and I can't wait to see out of all the different possibilities of what might have gone through your mind since I've asked you to do this, what you're going to come up with. So lay it on us.
Well, thank you. It was a big honor to be asked to be a part of this, and also very scary, too, to try and boil it all down to one idea. Yeah. I was kind of running through lots of different ideas, and as I was doing so, I kind of thought about all the different kinds of Mormon that I've been.
Oh, that's fun.
I was an existentialist Mormon, a Marxist Mormon, a pragmatist, a romantic, a classical philosophical theology traditions for a while. I kind of tried all these different ideas on, and out of that, I feel like has come up with a really sort of interesting result of what Mormonism looks like and what the ideas that have been most appealing to me are. But the one that I've kind of landed on lately is it's an idea that I hope to maybe develop a little bit more at some point too, is going back in some cases both to the early Christian notion, in some ways what perhaps the most central teaching of Jesus is around the kingdom of God, and the way that Mormonism tries to sort of reboot and reinvent this tradition with a kind of Zion society.
Okay, so good. So kingdom of God, Zion society, that's going to be your key focus.
And that's, yeah, I think that's where maybe by the end I'll talk myself out of it. But
no, I like it. No, so go for it. Unfold it, and I'll do my best to kind of draw out pieces from you.
So in the Gospels, I've been teaching a New Testament class this most recent term, and I've been rereading those again and part of my teaching. And it's been an idea that's always stuck out to me, but I've had the chance to revisit a little bit, is how central the teaching about the kingdom of God is in Jesus' preaching. In Mark, it's the very first thing that he says is that the kingdom of God is near. And this becomes a kind of controlling idea for what he's interested in. And the way that the church then gets established, the ecclesia after Jesus' death, is, in Pauline terms, is a kind of drawing on this ideal society that they're trying to anticipate in the coming, end of the world, I guess. And the kinds of ideals of what that society are going to look like, for Paul are that there shall be neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, neither male nor female, this kind of utopian society. And where Mormonism comes in with this is really trying to kind of reboot this notion of the kingdom of God in the Zion society. And Joseph Smith's early revelations and so much of Mormon scripture, even the Book of Mormon, is really about kind of building a new society that is more harmonious, where there's no more poor, and the kind of social divisions that exist among people are minimized. And I feel like that tradition has been so influential, not only in early Mormonism, but really kind of continues to this day in the way that, we don't always, of course, live up to these ideals, but the way that they structure so much of how we think about callings in the church and things along those lines, that where these kinds of social ideals of a better kind of society, more ideal society, are put into practice.
Definitely. So that's what captivates your mind the most? That's what captivates your heart? Is it something that you try through your own, you know, interactions on Sunday to make more explicit, or is it just something that you wish we'd remember a little bit more often? Because you're kind of saying that we do it, but yet I'm also guessing that you're like, I'd love to do it more.
Yeah.
You know, or something, you know.
Well, there's a way in which I think that having it be something that we do and also fail to do at the same time is kind of where the productivity of the work comes, I guess, if that makes sense.
Sure. You know, yeah.
There's a way in which a kind of acknowledgement of our imperfections, of our shortcomings, very much is what motivates us to strive towards this better kind of community. And I feel like we do this in a lot of ways. I mean, there's an experience that kind of defines a lot of the way that I think about church in the last couple of years. And it comes from an experience in a former ward. Just with a simple act of home teaching, I had kind of gotten this home teaching assignment to go visit this active family and thought, you know, this is just going to be a piece of cake. And my companion wasn't able to make it, so I just ended up there by myself that time and just kind of walked into a situation not having any expectations of there being any, you know, concerns or anything in that family, and really just kind of them laying out for me, you know, all these troubles that they had been having and this kind of overwhelming sense of grief that they had been experiencing with some things that had happened in their family and some extended family and economic problems and all kind, you know, basically everything that you could possibly imagine. And they had nobody on, they hadn't told anyone. And I just happened to be there at the right place at the right time. And I don't know, it's just, and I, you know, we remain friends to this day. It's been many, many years now, you know, but just a kind of simple act of going home teaching is one way that we kind of try and enact and enable a sort of better society, a place where we can have people to talk to and make those kinds of real connections between people.
Now, your, you know, broad background in religious studies and things like this, would you say that Mormonism is unique or just exceptionally good at or something like that in terms of its Zion vision and kind of the way the church works is kind of ahead of the pack in terms of, you know, bringing it about?
I'm not sure I would go about making a comparison along those lines about
okay.
whether we do it better or worse necessarily. We do it one way. I mean, I think that we have a lot to offer. There are a lot of things that we do really good that I think that other churches, other religious traditions could benefit from. But I think we also have lots to learn from the way that other communities operate and think about their own communities as well. So, but, you know, so I don't know. That's a good question. I didn't think about that angle on it. But in part, I think that I went to a divinity school and I went with people who were studying to be pastors, many of whom already were, who had been ordained in their traditions. And there was something that I had kind of envy about that.
Right.
I really envied the idea of having a trained ministry, people who really, you know, knew theology and knew the tradition and knew ways of sort of thinking critically about their own tradition. But on the other hand, there's something that I find just so wonderful about our tradition of everybody's an expert and everybody, can serve a mission and everybody can, get basically enough competency in the tradition to feel perfectly comfortable. And we don't have a sort of two-tiered church system necessarily in terms of education and training. So there's something that I really like about that, the kind of democratization of spirituality, of knowledge, of access to, you know, what Mormonism has to offer, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I think that works too, and that's a beautiful thing. Now, you're aware enough of the tradition that, you know, or at least that demographic within Mormonism that are sort of struggling with some sort of, you know, the old formulas of Mormonism aren't quite working. I'd love to stay connected if I can, but I'm not sure that I can. And a lot of the things that kind of drive, you know, folks crazy who are kind of in that big time of upheaval in their life are things that in some ways having trained clergy would help
yeah.
with. What what's your advice? I mean, either, you know, I don't know how much about your own life and your own spiritual journey or something like that, but when you've had your ups and downs, or when you're, you know, close friends or something have had ups or downs, is there any clues that can kind of say, you know, remember this Zion community ideal, this Kingdom of God stuff, and does it somehow mitigate some of the issues or anything like that?
Well, this is an excellent question. I have to say, I sometimes have been dismayed at my own unpersuasiveness on this particular point and others with some of my friends. But I can tell you what works for me and how I think about it. And I guess there's a certain sort of a different theories of religion. What is religion, right? And one of the our tradition very much takes a part of as well is what I would call, in general, a kind of intellectualist or personal approach to religion. Not intellectualist in the sense that it intellectualizes in some profound way. We can hardly be accused of that too often. But in the sense that we think of religion as a set of ideas, as a set of kind of, you know, statements about the world. And there's certainly some aspects of Mormonism that are like that, and it may even be the dominant way that Mormonism is understood. But for me, the notion of where the Kingdom of God comes into play and in terms of thinking about community touches on a whole different tradition in religions and in Christianity and in Mormonism, I think, too, around spiritual practices. And so it's less about a set of dogmas or a set of sort of, as I said, statements, intellectualist statements about the world, but more a set of how it is that you go about engaging and thinking about the person that you're interacting with, the nature of the community that you're building, the kinds of ideals of a society that you're trying to build. And it's so more about the things that you're doing than about necessarily the things that you believe. So that's why I say that experience of my home Tichy was one that really touched me. I was like, okay, this is what Mormonism is about. This is these kinds of moments, these kinds of experiences, rather than, you know, what so-and-so said in the Journal of Discourses or something like that.
Right. And so when theology or teachings are, you know, because you say pretty much anybody can develop that competency and contribute and all that stuff, but when it's particularly narrow or when it does get tinged with politics or something that kind of drives you crazy, what's your technique? Is it simply tune out, only watch? I mean, when do you decide to intervene? When don't you decide to intervene? You know, how is it that you can kind of keep this vision in front of your face during the most difficult times?
Well, people are going to answer that differently. And in some respects, I feel like I have a lot of luxury to not feel like I have to intervene. I've never really felt the burden of needing to correct people or step in, you know, I don't know. That's just never been my style. Different people.
So it's a personality, temperament kind of thing.
I think so, to some extent. And some of it is, I think, a level of, you know, maturity isn't quite the right word, but sort of a level of getting past it. You know, I mean, there was a stage where I definitely felt desperate in church sometimes of, you know, these people don't understand what I understand and they call all the issues that I want to sort of engage with, you know. I guess I just found other avenues outside of church to feel like that wasn't the place that I needed to do that, you know. I guess, yeah. I've also been really blessed to be in fantastic wards, so that helps. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
being in Cambridge, sure. Massachusetts, and actually even here in Kalamazoo, we've had a fantastic ward community. I haven't ever felt really alienated from my ward in a long time, so that helps, I think, too. But I don't know, I guess a lot of it, as I say, it's more about what you do than about how you, you know, how you present yourself or present your ideas, you know. And so I guess, you know, picking up chairs after events and, you know, making cookies for people at the holidays. And, you know, I think those are the kinds of spiritual practices that I care about and that I'm sort of thinking about. Those are the things that really can help to build a community. You know, you'll take your opportunities to teach and to kind of maybe change people's perspectives or to help reach out to those people who are also struggling, who need a hand. You take those opportunities where you can get them, but they don't define it for me, I guess.
Awesome. Thank you, man. That's been exciting. I've loved hearing about this.
Sure. I hope I hope somebody finds some usefulness in what I have to say and how I'm thinking about things right now, and I hope to learn from other people too.
They totally will. Thank you so much. Before we leave this, and I've loved everything you've said so far, I guess that works. And it works for somebody who I think just enjoys being a Mormon, who maybe is a social being, somebody who just, craves community, and they grant a lot of tolerance. I think sometimes my stuff comes, I have this pretty wild and crazy family, so there's a little bit of chaos that I kind of am used to, and I still love my family members, and they love me with all my weirdness and quirks and stuff like that too. But there, for some people, I hear a lot from it is like, if it, the church isn't true in this capital T way, if it isn't, if these claims aren't exactly it, if the prophet hasn't been able to sort through the mess and the chaos of all the competing things and kind of said, this truly is God's will and that isn't God's will, if they get to that point there and they say, why bother is kind of their question. How would you get them to shift more towards your perspective or something like that? Or is there ideas that you could tell, or is it just what would you give the advice to that person?
Well, this is where I have found studying religion actually really, really useful for framing how I think about religion as a phenomenon, as a human phenomenon at the end of the day. And, about finding the familiar, finding what Mormonism shares with other religious traditions that for some people, may be disconcerting to them. We don't have it uniquely here or something like that. But for me, it's actually quite reassuring to say, okay, we've got it right, because so many other people are thinking about it in the same way as well.
Oh, nice.
So, and I guess for me, it's ultimately a question, not to use too big of vocabulary words necessarily here, but a kind of epistemological question about how we think about truth. And I think, unfortunately, we have spent too much of the 20th century too closely engaged with the kind of Protestant fundamentalism that came as a reaction to the scientific paradigm that developed in the 19th century around truth and the kind of fundamentalism that then emerged in response to that adopted the same kind of notion of it has to be absolutely this way, and it has to be unverifiable, and it has to match up to all of these criteria for knowledge. And I guess I just don't think of knowledge in those terms anymore. And in a way, probably one of the best expounders, in my opinion, in the modern church for non-fundamentalist ways of thinking about Mormonism has got to be Terrell Gibbons, who, coming from a romanticism as a kind of background of his thinking, frames up a whole new way of thinking about truth and meaning that has its roots in a long Western intellectual tradition, and he fits Mormonism right into that, and I think there's a lot to say about that. I'm myself a little bit more of a sort of postmodernist than a romanticist, but there's a lot that I find that's meaningful there. And so I guess it's just about rethinking the kinds of ways that we go about thinking about truth. So I'm sympathetic to the kind of fundamentalist notions of Mormonism and then the reactions to that as people sort of emerge out of fundamentalism to new ways of thinking about truth. But it's just, I don't know, I just am not persuaded that that was ever the right way to think about truth to begin with. So I've never been that perturbed by, well, I shouldn't say I've never been. I'm no longer bothered by not thinking about truth in those kind of really constraining ways at the end of the day. And I think meaning and other ways of kind of approaching life that are besides those sorts of demands for absolute truth are much richer.
I agree, but getting there, especially when the other is the dominant, even if it was never the right approach and things like that, is difficult. And so I know I struggle with it, and I'm sure you do too. But
the other thing I would say about it, just to jump in here, I'm not that old, I guess, but it seems like a really exciting time to be a Mormon right now. There's so much going on that's so much, that's interesting. And I think that we're in a real period of transition too. And for me, I'd rather be a part of the solution, a part of sticking around and redefining what this new age of Mormonism is going to look like. And I hope that other people will stick around and be a part of that with me. So that's the other thing.
Yeah. I hope they will too. And I'm glad for you in the trenches with us, brother. So thank you so much for sharing all this.
Thank you.
It's been great. And figure out other reasons to get you on the show as soon as I can, man. I love it. Take care.
Sure thing. Thanks a lot, Dan. Appreciate it.
I'm excited to introduce my next guest to you as well, and this is Rick Jepson. Rick, this will be his first time on the podcast proper, but kind of early on, I was doing these sort of side podcasts with Mormon Matters, and we did a thing called Matters of Perspective, where I had authors of articles that I really like read their articles, so that those who like to digest good thinking and good scholarship, you know, through their ears rather than their eyes, would have a chance to be exposed to this article. So it's called God Wrestling, and it just, it's about Jacob and the angel and the biblical story, but it's also about physicality and sort of redemption through struggle, and it's got amazing theological ramifications and insights, and it draws on scholarship, it draws on great breadth of reading and things like this. And so it's interesting, I've just been asked to write an essay for the 40th anniversary of the Sunstone, which many of you know I directed from 2001 to 2008, and among the things they've asked me is to list my top 10 things that I ever published there, and I've got this one number one, and so I just love it that much. So I'm going to link to both the oral version that we did through the podcast as well as the written one for us, so I hope you'll read it. But Rick is one of these interesting guys in the sense that he didn't go on to get advanced degrees in, you know, academic kind of subjects, which is seems like probably have overrepresented here anyway. But he is an RN, and even as he was working as a nurse, he kept an academic interest, and he published things on, you know, kind of diagnostic stuff that nurses can spot, that because they're with the patients so much more often than what doctors can do and things like that. And so he's always kept this academic kind of interest. After his nursing career, he ended sort of into hospital administration and now just general healthcare management. I know he works with a company that provides dialysis to lots of different hospitals and things like that. So he's actively involved with this. But anyway, just one of these great polymaths of sorts who just have this really active mind while they're kind of pursuing more professional type things rather than pursuits that are generally thought, you just don't generally think of them as you know, thought leader type professional stuff. Rick is married. He lives in the Boise, Idaho area. That's a home base. He's married to Wendy, and they have two wonderful children. And together, the two of them have a blog that I enjoy reading called the Red Balloon Blog. And it's kind of alternating. One week, Rick writes. The next week, Wendy writes. And it's day-to-day kind of things and things like this. But there's also an awful lot of just good, solid stuff about life as a Mormon family. So it's a terrific blog. I hope you'll check it out. Like Taylor, Rick also picked something just a little more down to earth, something just a little bit more about Christian service and those kinds of things that really make Mormonism stand out to him. And I was really, really happy to also have him, you know, say something that's hard, which is that, you know, there's a lot of street cred that we kind of give to people that express doubts. You know, it's like, oh, you know, I'm standing up for my truth and all that kind of stuff. And he basically, you know, honors that certainly as courage, but there's kind of just giving yourself over to service and to loving other people and things like that that some ways anyway, it just needed to be said what he says here. So stick around all the way through this segment because he nails something I think that's very, very important and at least something worth a great deal of thought. So this is my segment with Rick Jepson. So Rick, old friend here, tell me, Mormonism, I know you're active. I know that you've had periods of time where in and out, a little bit less certain that you could make it work and stuff like that. But, you know, if you had to pick one out of all the different kinds of things that do keep you kind of hanging in the Mormon orbit and feeling positive about the gospel and the church stuff, what would it be?
That's a really good and a really tough question. And I've been thinking about that quite a bit the last couple of weeks, especially a couple of very close friends are kind of on the beginning end of that question and having a harder time actively being in the church or feeling comfortable in the church or at least feeling comfortable expressing testimony in the church and feel compelled to do so or feel like they're in a calling where that would be expected.
Oh, yeah. Definitely adds a layer of trouble.
Yeah. So, you know, really struggling there. I think, I guess in a sense, I have sort of an outcomes-based approach to my testimony. And I don't know that that's the right approach for everyone or not. And I'm sure it's not, actually. In what I do at work, and nearly everything is based on outcomes. You know, we look at certain issues and we create kind of a barrage of tests or a barrage of actions to try and affect an outcome. And the whatever interventions we use that do work are the ones we stick with. And sometimes we don't know. So, for example, if somebody has a chance of getting pneumonia when they're intubated, you know, we'll throw five or six things at them. And if we show that those five or six things in concert work really, really well to prevent pneumonia, then we keep doing all five or six of those, even though sometimes we don't know, maybe it's just one or two of those that's really making the key difference. And over time, you can kind of whittle those down. I'd say a few years ago, we were struggling with tithing, and we were at the same time struggling financially. We just were in the middle of a move. We had a house for sale plus a new mortgage. We had a new job, and just it was just a very challenging time. And we really thought about it and honestly really prayed about it as a couple and felt like it was time to pay tithing and that somehow would make the difference. And in my mind, I just thought, or in my brain, I guess, I just thought, how could having one more payment when I already feel like I can't afford the payments I have, how could that make the difference? And I'd say we went and paid tithing, and just a day or two later, I remember going over to my bishop's house and just telling him, you know, I have to say that Wendy and I feel a clarity now around our finances. We feel like we have a plan. We feel like we understand where we're at. We understand how to get to our next step and what to do from there. And we haven't had that this whole time. And I really believe that honoring that law and making that sacrifice and doing that work brought us to where we needed to be. And I think my current sort of modern testimony really built on that. I'd say that it's doing the work, engaging in the work of the church and the work of the gospel and seeing those outcomes that really make a huge difference for me and that really draw me to the church. I think I'm a big fan of organizations, and I think it's incredibly hard for a large organization to consistently meet needs across a broad scope. And it's always amazing to me when I sit in Sunday school, and sometimes I think the lessons in Sunday school or the lessons in Elders Quorum or in Relief Society are unduly criticized by people. That, you know, we kind of overdo it in saying that they're boring or they're generic or whatever. And I just think how amazing it is that this same lesson is being taught, you know, in Mormonville, Idaho, where I live. And it's also being taught in Japan and in Kenya and in a rich neighborhood and in a poor neighborhood. And, you know, everyone's getting the same lesson, and that somebody worked very, very hard and prayed very, very hard to create an education system that would somehow be digestible to and helpful to a really broad range of people. So I look at that a lot, and I think as an organization, I'm just amazed at how well the church works at what it does best. And I'm sort of in awe of it and have a hard time when I see it in operation, believing that it could come from anything but real, true inspiration.
So yeah, distilling, is it, you said, what's the best thing about Mormonism, or what's the best thing, was it just doing the work of the, I'm trying to pick out what you picked, what you said in there.
Yeah, that's good. I feel like I'm almost exploring as we go, but yeah, I guess what I'd say is a decade ago, I'd say that I believed in the doctrine of the church, but I struggled with the organization of the church. Today, I feel like I have a massive and almost unfaltering testimony of the organization of the church itself. And that allows me to feel comfortable with the doctrine of the church, where I sometimes understand it and I sometimes don't. I sometimes am very motivated by it, and in other areas I'm very uncomfortable with it. But the structure of the church itself, the work that it does and the outcomes that it produces, I think are just huge evidence of its fitness and of its effect and of, I believe, it a very divine-inspired origin and support.
Okay, you're outcome-oriented, and I know that you're also aware of a lot of people for whom the organization, the one size fits all, just doesn't fit. And so as you're kind of talking broad outcomes, that's great. But on the individual level, I know that I've struggled, you've struggled, but somewhere along the lines, when and where did that shift from you from, you know, worrying so much about yourself or the particularities of the individual to just this larger, you know, vision of really embracing the church?
So I would say that I made a conscious effort to focus more on other people than on myself, and more on the work I could do for other people and the good I could do through the organization of the church, rather than on what the church was doing for me in terms of settling my mind, for example. And so I don't feel like I put any of my doubts or questions or even struggles on hold, or ignore them. I don't feel like I turn away from them at all. If anything, I sometimes think I embrace them more now than I ever have. But what I would say is I worry first about, have I done a really great job home teaching this week or this month? And do my families genuinely feel like they're supported? And if they needed help in the middle of the night, do they feel comfortable calling me? Do I get to church 30 or 20 minutes early and try and look around the room and see who there maybe could use some help or would benefit from me sitting down and chit-chatting with them or checking in on them? Have I called my siblings? Have I, I work in our ward choir, and have I really made a strong effort to get people out and make sure that we have strong participation so that when the next singing piece comes up, we really do a great job for the ward? I don't feel like in the toughest times of my own struggle or my attention to my own struggle, I don't feel like I was doing any of those things. I think my approach to the church was, what can it do for me? The more that I have tried to focus on what I can do through the church for others, the more I've been able to appreciate sort of the humanity of the church and the human nature of the church. A lot of what I have questions on or struggle with just occurs to me as great human beings muddling through a doctrine that we don't always understand very well. I think today is a great example where I kind of had a hard time with one of the lessons today at church. I felt like the emphasis was on a social issue that wasn't totally pertinent, and that I found myself at odds with the teacher and with much of the class. And instead of feeling isolated by that or upset about that or defensive about that, like I would have, I just thought, I sure love this person teaching it, and I'm so glad I got to, you know, work with them last month and go visit this family, and I'm so glad I had them over to my house for dinner, and how interesting that we see this one issue so very differently from each other, and that's okay.
And you didn't feel like you needed to really speak up and announce that you're at odds with them at this time, or is this something you might do privately next time you are serving next to each other or something?
That's a great question, because you do wonder, to what extent am I just turning into sort of a complacent person or a coward? Am I just more afraid to pick fights than I used to be? I think what I hope is going through my mind is, what good will come of this? What good will come of me raising my hand and saying,
right,
hey, I really disagree with this. I think you're all way off base, and I don't think this is an appropriate topic for, you know, what we're actually here to talk about today. Whereas I think if I talk to that person in private the next time we're serving together, maybe a lot of good could come of that. Or maybe my own thinking, my own bias would be tested, and a lot of good would come of that. So sometimes I think I definitely keep to myself more than I used to. I'm much less likely to stir the pot in Elders Quorum or something. And sometimes I think that's prudence. It's probably often cowardice or wanting very much to belong to this group.
Right, right.
That's probably changed over time.
Yeah, there's costs for any association, for sure. Yeah, and you have to pick your moments, and you have to say, is this the hill I want to die on, or is this the one that I really want to, you know, run my spiel about? Yeah, interesting. Now, let me go back and clarify a couple things. Back to the tithing thing and how you felt like, you know, once you made that decision, you got this clarity and things like this. And then also the thing about, you know, going early and serving and who can I help. And in neither case, I don't sense, I know you, you know, well through the years and things like this. My guess is there wasn't any sense of like, God will bless me with this, or maybe there was, or there is for that, but it's more like, what happened there? It's not like out of guilt. It's probably not like out of any sense that God was punishing you guys with your, not clarity in your finances and stuff like that. So is it more like it's just the forward thrust of my life that I think did it? Or do you think this really was God was withholding a blessing and now is doing it in terms on the tithing front? Or I'm doing this things because I want blessings in my life?
Yeah. No, I think for me, what it really comes down to is you can't really participate in the church if you're not really giving to it. I think some blessings don't come if you don't do the work. And I think that's true in life. And I think a loving parent, would say to their child, I really want you to go to the best university. And, I really want you to have the greatest chances you can in life, and I'll help you and I'll make opportunities and I'll show you the way. And if you're just not willing to do the work, you're still not going to get there. And so this, it's funny. I think the best discourse on prayer is probably also the best discourse on works that we have. And it's in the, of all places, it's in the Bible dictionary that just says that praying is a kind of work that we do. And it is a way that we try to align what we most want with what our Heavenly Father most wants. And I'd say it's the same thing with any work we do in the church is our goal is to better understand what our Heavenly Father wants and to better do the work for that. And I think as we strive to align those things, a lot of other things become peripheral. There are a number of social issues right now that the church is engaged in fairly heavily. Some of those are really tough for me. Some of those, I look at it, and I feel very confident that my daughter or my granddaughter will be in a very different church than I am now, just like I'm in a very different church in some ways than my grandparents were, or even my parents were, especially in regards to race or the way that people in the church understood race. I look at that and I'm comfortable with the fact that I expect the church to grow that way, and I expect my own family to see improvements and changes and live in a different church than I do. But I would say that concern for me is secondary to my concerns about, am I doing the right work in the church? Are my children feeling the Spirit every day? And are they able to engage with their feeling of the Spirit to make the right decisions at school or with friends? Is there need out there that could be met by me and sometimes very easily met by me, and I'm ignoring it out of selfishness? And all those things are so much, I think, more pertinent that I give a lot of precedence to that. And I'm more willing to bide my time and hopefully be a positive influence on some of these issues. But at one point, those were central. Those were the top things on my mind.
Right. But none of this shift was out of guilt, out of like, oh, God's withholding blessings from me, as much as it's just like, I just need to be more proactive.
Yeah, no, I don't ever feel like I felt guilt. I certainly never felt guilt for asking questions or digging into issues. The other thing that I think really helped me and surprised me was finding how much information really is so easily available. I think we have a common criticism in the church, and I've made this criticism, that the history we get from church has been scrubbed or is very, very simplified. And I would agree that when my kids hear the story of Joseph Smith in primary, it is very compressed, and necessarily so. I really support that compression. I actually don't think we go to church to get a history lesson. But there's almost a perception that means that there's not great information available out there. And I think more than ever, there's a huge accessibility to history and to very open exploration. There's great work that a lot of thought leaders have done, and you're one of those. But you look at this great ability to study and to question and to think, and there are wonderful examples of very scholarly approaches to that among people who remain very faithful. And realizing that there's really no limit to what I can think about, and there's no reason to feel guilty about thinking or questioning, but it's all out there, and there are people who know a lot more than I do and are also quite a bit more faithful and involved in their wards than I am, did put my mind at ease quite a bit.
Okay, so I'm going to try to do a little summary here and tell me if I've got it right. So I've picked up that pretty much every question, every issue that you always had, none of them are resolved. It's not like you have this big sagging shelf of I put my questions on it, I put my concerns on it, and I'm just going to ignore it and turn my attention here. Those are all there, but it sounds a little bit like you're saying that as I just decided, okay, I'm going to make a stride in this area. I'm gonna walk this way. I'm gonna act this way. I'm gonna, you know, increase my vision outward to find more people that I could draw in and possibly influence for good. It's almost like saying it's kind of like the mixer, you know, the equalizer, the mixer on the soundboard or something like that. As the one kind of moved up, the other is still there, but it proportionally kind of faded. Is that at all close to what you're saying?
Yeah, I think you could say that it faded, or in some sense, just my stress about it faded.
Okay.
And probably, I guess faded is right, because I think my attention has faded as well. They're not things that I ignore, and they're not things that I would say I've sort of put into a box or put on the shelf, but they're not things that I guess I don't allow myself the luxury of a whole lot of fretting over them until I've done all my work, till my cannery assignment is done and my home teaching's done and my lessons prepared. And that's a great time. That's a great time to sit down and dig into the history and ask really tough questions.
When you're preparing your lesson, is that what you meant by that?
No, I mean, you know, when you're in that place where...
When you've got this perspective of,
yeah.
Yeah, of less stress about it. Nothing's coming to a full stop until I get an answer to this question. Yeah, you're never really going to get that perspective, are you?
You know, another funny change happened to me, and that is that we moved. And I was hired into a new job at a time when they really needed new leadership. And I was told on my first day by the person that I was replacing, within the first 30 minutes, she told me that the only reason I had gotten the job was that they wanted a Mormon guy. And so even though I was underqualified and really not gifted and, you know, not a good fit, I was hired because I was a Mormon. And that rumor was so strong that I was known for a good year as the guy who shouldn't really be here, but he's just here because he's a Mormon. And that gave me a lot of thought about what does that mean to them that I'm a Mormon, and what does it mean to me, and what about my behavior or my language or the way that I talk about my wife, all those things. How will those reflect what it means to be a Mormon to them, or how will those help define what it means to me? And that probably had a bigger influence on me than I sometimes realize. Was sort of having that period of very intense scrutiny where I felt like I needed to prove to an entire group of people I worked with that I was there because I was the right person for the job who happened to be Mormon, instead of just a Mormon who got the job because of internal connections. And I think what I eventually taught to myself was, and maybe to some other people, was, no, I was the right person for this job, and I had the right background, and I'm a hard enough worker and good enough at what we do that I can be successful in this job. But a lot of that actually comes from being a Mormon. And so in some ways, it's not totally wrong to say I got this job because I'm a Mormon, because being a Mormon means, and growing up in an active family in the church means that I know how to speak in front of people. I know how to work on a group assignment. I know how to have my performance measured on things that don't seem measurable. I can sit through meetings. I can, you know, behave appropriately in the right environment. And all of those things came to me from being a Mormon. And so it gave me a chance to sort of align my professional and personal spiritual life with a really strong magnifying lens over me. And that probably shaped a lot of my current confidence as a member of the church.
And I love this stuff, and I love the happiness and the peace, and I'm getting that you just have really kind of come to this neat, you know, coalescence of things that have, you know, making you happy. I guess my main question is, yes, this can happen within Mormonism. We know it happens a lot within Mormonism. When some people feel that they can't do it within Mormonism, are you thinking that they can do it somewhere else, but as long as it's somewhere else where there's some sort of community involved, or something that you actually take some responsibility and service, toward or something like that, versus there's uniquely God's spirit or some combination of specific teachings within Mormonism that only make it really work here?
So I want to tread that water very carefully, because I have a mixed response to that. Of course I believe that there are wonderful people all over the place, some of whom have never heard of Mormonism and never will, some of whom are not active Mormons, or some of whom are maybe even completely against the church or have very bad feelings toward the church, can still be happy and productive people. And of course, I believe that's true. And at the same time, so it would be hard for me to say, well, my way is the only way. But at the same time, I do sincerely believe to my bones that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a special organization, that it is specially set up and specially guided. And I do believe that there are a combination of factors within that organization and real spiritual guidance within that organization that make it uniquely capable of doing a lot of good in the world and of producing a lot of happiness. I think the point of the gospel is to be happy and to make other people happy. And I think it's a positive doctrine. But I think that the doctrines of the church and the organization of the church are unique in the world insofar as I've experienced it. Now, I do have, and I have to say, I do have some biases that sort of run me toward that, and they surprise me. My own biases sort of, my own biased experience sort of surprises me, where I've thought of myself as being sort of argumentative or liberal or sort of an outsider. At least superficially, I'm like the perfect demographic of the stereotypical happy Mormon guy. I'm a 30-something white guy who's in business and has a wife and two cute kids and, live in the suburbs. And so we sort of, it may very well be that I'm demographically predisposed to really have a different experience in the church than someone else might have, and that it might have been easier for me to navigate a long period of struggle in the church and re-find my place in it due to just a lot of factors of kind of who I am and where I live and what my education level is like. And I want to be careful that I don't superimpose that on other people. And at the same time, in my own wandering and in my own exploration and talking to other people and visiting other people and really trying very hard to explore other institutions and other ways of thought, I have found all of the negative things that I find in the church and that I find in any human institution, and that's prejudice and sort of phobia of outsiders and internal fighting and positioning, jockeying for position, that kind of thing. All those things that we see in the church and that people can be very critical of in the church, I found those anywhere. I found those in any school organization. And I'm reminded a lot of, I've had the great opportunity to work with you in Sunstone and to meet a lot of the splendid people from Sunstone. And my first time ever going to a real kind of event, I got cornered by someone who probably told me 12 times in the conversation that they had been excommunicated. And it came across very clear that in that social hierarchy that one person belonged to, I wasn't going to be able to really be as cool as them until I had been excommunicated.
I've been in conversations like that, yeah.
And I thought, well, this is, I can be critical of the church where someone can say, someone can really hold something over your head about their calling or where they went to school or what their, who their parents knew at BYU or that kind of thing. But that happens everywhere. The real positive spirit, the real serenity that I get, the real tangible and organized opportunities that I have to serve, I do not find elsewhere. And so I do believe the church is a special place and an exceptional place.
Awesome. Dude, thanks so much, man. Love chatting with you. Love catching up and learning this place that you're at right now. I'm so thrilled that you guys are just serving like crazy.
Well, it's funny. I've been very nervous about the interview, and I got very nervous during it. It's funny. I was rereading Elder Holland's talk from a year and a half ago or 2 years ago, the Help Thou My Unbelief or My Disbelief.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And it's funny. I think we put some capital on public expressions of doubt, and we treat that like that's really brave and takes a lot of guts. And I know that sometimes it does. Mm-hmm. In my own case, I don't think it does. In my own case, I think it's pretty easy to say, oh yeah, no, I don't know if it's true. I don't know if it's special. And it's much harder, I think, to go on the record and say, no, I really do have a testimony of the church. I really do have a testimony of the gospel. I'm much more nervous saying that than I am about expressing doubts. And it's an interesting point. So this is a very challenging interview for me, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Dude, it'll resonate with many people here. I think there's lots of us who get ourselves in those situations to where it is much easier to you know, almost talk third person, you know, the Mormons versus we, you know, or something like that. I know that was a struggle for me at one point in my life to just simply own the craziness and the full load of what it means to be LDS, and I love a positive affirmation of that. So thank you so much.
I reread the book The Why I Stay that Robert Reese and I found some of it very helpful. Some of it I didn't as much, but you know, the his own closing comments where he talked about, and now I'm going to botch the name, Levi Savage, where he talked about Levi Savage,
the dissenting opinion about going with the handcart company,
has a dissenting opinion, but it says, hey, but if this is the way you're going to go, I'm going to go with you. I'm going to help you suffer through it. I'm not going to be smug about it, and we're all going to get somewhere together. You know, I'm in it with you. That really summed up my place in the church when it comes to some of the issues that I struggle with, especially some of the political or social issues that really get highlighted and sometimes overemphasized. It's kind of the same thing. It's like, okay, this is not how I see it. I'd rather we not take the hand carts, but if you're gonna, and it's going to be painful and it's going to be tough, and at the end we'll still make it, and I'll be there with you every step of the way.
Dude, thank you so much. Really loved having you on here and putting your voice out in this this community again. You've your article, God Wrestling, still my favorite ever, and I hope people lots will read that, and just appreciate your courage speaking up here.
I sure appreciate the chance to participate with you today. Take care.
My final guest is by far the most well-known to the listeners of this podcast. We've had her on many, many times. It's Gina Colvin. She is our wonderful commentator on cultural issues. She is a professor at, I don't think they call him professors, lecturer or something, over at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. And she teaches education in the education department, but focuses mostly on things like colonization and how ideas are transmitted, and just she kind of notices all the subtle things that go on in power structures and whatnot. And so she is just always a fascinating person. Many of you will know her from her blog, which is Kiwi Mormon, which is hosted over at Patheos, the Patheos website, and I'll link to that here in the description on the Mormon Matters website. But Gina is a powerful voice. It was fun to have her over in the States for a few weeks just recently. But you'll remember that, you know, there's this passion that she speaks with. And, you know, she's always calling the church to something better and something, you know, live up to its ideals. Or she's always saying, you know, well, this is a pretty American idea that you're kind of thrusting on the rest of the world and things like this. But there's a deep affection and a love for Mormonism that's always there. And I just thought it would be great to hear what she came up with. And I just am laughing at what she finally settled on. And I think you'll enjoy it. It is strange that this turned out to be my shortest segment of the four. She was the first one that we did, and so I was everybody, hey, we're going to stick with 15 minutes, you know, kind of thing max for each person, and we've kind of violated that with the others as we went going. But the shortest, but also a wonderful just kind of affirmation of Mormonism here from Gina Colvin. So welcome to my segment with Gina. Gina, I'm so excited to have you back to the podcast. We always love having you on.
Thank you so much, Dave. Very excited about this one.
Yeah, this will be interesting. We're just trying something new here. What have you picked out of all the possibilities? Or maybe there were only a few possibilities that really struck you, but what about Mormonism, you know, captures your mind or your imagination, or you just think it's kind of a good thing and a cool thing, and it's part of at least the equation of why you stay and you know, fight so hard for a great home in Mormonism?
Wow, you know, since you asked me this question, it's been running over my mind frantically, and nothing really. I mean, I could have talked about my own charismatic experiences, the way that my spiritual awakenings, the way that the church didn't necessarily facilitate that, but gave me the language to interpret it. I could talk about community and how fabulous and wonderful I believe the people to be. I could talk about aspects of the doctrine. I mean, there's a lot. I could talk about the rhythm of being a Mormon. The sociality of it and the way that it kind of structures and organizes my time and my day and, you know, what I think about. But do you know what? The thing that kept coming back to me was I love it because it's absolutely bonkers.
Love it. That's terrific.
You know, and I think about the landscape of my memory and everything that brings back smiles, you know, happened within the context of the church, you know, that kind of the extraordinary sort of the laughter, the kind of the nuts, the messiness of it, the chaos of it, and the whole paradox of it all, this sort of sacred, profane thing that we vacillate between. When you just take one step back, you think, man, this place is crazy fun. So,
Nice.
You know, that's kind of what came to me.
So is this analogy work? You know, I don't know if you ever saw that movie, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, you know, where this, you know, she just, you know, she's so certain that this family is going to overwhelm him. He's, you know, it's just her particularity, but yet it's a fun particularity. It's a fun strangeness, and it's, you know, quote unquote ours. It's, you know, it's our family. It's our craziness.
Yes, it is. We're sort of enacting this sort of strange walk of sacredness and holiness, but you kind of scrape away the surface. A lot of it's just madness. You know, and I don't mean to say that to offend people who find a real beauty in that sort of, you know, and a grace in it, because I think it can be graceful and beautiful at the same time as being this sort of mad thing that's going on.
Yeah, so, I mean, do you believe that sort of the cosmos itself has sort of a comic core to it, or is there anything like that that you're kind of saying this is a mimicking, or are you saying that, and are you saying that Mormonism is more bonkers than pretty much any other group that gets together and takes itself seriously?
I think it's bonkers in a really unique way. Yeah, and I do think there is a cosmic, you know, comic quality to the cosmos. Do you know, one of the young women who does a lot of our babysitting, she said to me on the way home when I was dropping her off a couple of weeks ago, she said, what do you think Jesus would laugh at? And I thought, what a good question. I said, I think that he'd laugh at our church. I think he'd laugh at me. You know?
Yeah.
So I think he'd laugh
but
at me.
But with affection, not like as in, yeah.
Not mockery. Not
right,
mockery.
Right.
And in fact, I kind of venture to think, you know, I don't want people to think that I'm being kind of, you know, rude about the religion, but I'm not. I say this with the deepest affection, that there are sort of juxtapositions and there are paradoxes and contradictions that about our church, I think that even Jesus would get a giggle at, you know.
And are they mostly because of the culture, or do you think they're because of the teachings, or is it just when you have lay leadership, or what do you think are the main reasons for our particular brand of weirdness?
I think the culture, but I mean, there are a couple of examples that I was thinking of. Do you know, years ago, and I think anybody who's been in the church in places where it's just a startup church, those are the times where it's really the most fun, because you've got this sort of open mic policy where anybody and their craziness can come and share their deepest, most innermost sacred feelings, and that sometimes goes off center, as you possibly know.
Right.
I was a member of a ward, and it's kind of my home ward, but we'd had a stake reorganization a couple of years ago where I don't know what it was when I was growing up as a teenager, but we had a lot of people with mental illnesses, people who were not very well educated. Okay, and that's fine. Every congregation has, you know, well, you know, most faith traditions has that kind, you know, those kind of people. But our faith tradition gives them a mic every month. Like every month,
right,
get to talk. and so we just had some mad, mad stuff happen. And it used to embarrass the crap out of me when I was a kid. I was like, oh, my gosh, this is just so embarrassing. But I look back and I look back with, like, genuine affection at those times as we month after month, we allowed these people to say that, you know, nuts things. And we had this one Sister McDonald who used to get up and invite people to come to her wedding with Elvis Presley. And she was like about 80 and he was dead. So, you know, it was just, you know, all this kind of, and there would be fights over the podium as one person sort of tried to out another person. Or
whoa.
It was just hilarious looking back. You know, and I just think that kind of our encounter with people struggling to find the divine within them and trying, each of us trying to be certain about, you know, about our own truth claims, certain about our own testimonies, leads to this wonderful kind of cacophony of voices, which, you know, if it doesn't make you cry, it's going to make you laugh. So look, I'm not saying that to diminish the sacred in any way. I'm just saying it to point out that the necessity that we have to take care of our own, the necessity that we have that we feel to take care of our own means that we have to have this high tolerance for paradox. Mm-hmm. Except in Orem. In Orem, they have no high tolerance for paradox. You know, I've been to church there. I know that. I could bear my testimony of it. But you know, there is this sort of turning things around. Like in most, it used to bother me that we didn't have, like the Catholics have this sort of, you know, this unit of the church that works out doctrine and theology, and that we don't have a trained laity. And we don't really, you know, kind of have a strong and robust sort of theology that is really that accessible. So, and because leaders for the most part are chosen because they're not mystics. They're chosen because they can do the business. They can manage this big kind of discursive organization. So the cool thing is that our mystics and our theologians are all among us. We walk with them every day, and that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. So, I love that our religion has opened up the possibilities of the sacred to each of us, that we can each be our own mystic, that we can each be deeply engaged in working out and wrestling with each other over our theology. And so the kind of the managerialism is a way of containing all of that, because if it just sort of got away on us, you know, all hell would break loose and we'd, you know, have Mormons, you know, Mark 1, 2 and 3 and 4. But, yeah, so that's kind of the what I'm thinking of.
I love it. Thank you so much. That is hilarious, but also very profound. And at one point I was going to ask you, and it sounds like I know the answer now, is you wouldn't have it any other way, right? Or I mean, I know you know, there's critiques always. There's a shadow side to every gift. And so you're emphasizing the gift here. But would you trade, you know, toning it down at all because of the shadow for a little less?
You know, I think because we are really, I think the people are powerful. I think we're extraordinarily powerful, more powerful than we think, because I don't think that we own the power that we have as a people in steering the boat. But the boat will go where we the people want it to go. Sounds really American, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But I think that you have to have the voice of dissent, otherwise you'll implode on yourself. You know, you need to have channels of release so that we can actually include dissent and include critique within the broader conversation. And each part of that kind of contributes to a health of the organization, because I think we need to be healthy. And it's not that we have to walk lockstep with each other, we just need health. And that means sometimes addressing imbalances, and I think we do have a sex imbalance, you know, a really oppressive sex imbalance. I think we're overmanaged, and I don't think we feel very spiritually empowered, because we kind of, you know, we imagine they call themselves prophets, but they're not really mystics, are they? I mean, when was the last mystic that we had?
Yeah, good point. Maybe Elder Maxwell.
Yeah, I think so, Elder Maxwell. And then you have the mystics on the outside, you know, who kind of speak to the center. But we're not managed by mystics. We're managed by managers. Yeah. And that's an imbalance that needs to be addressed as well. But what I'm really grateful for is that we get to be part of that conversation. That notwithstanding that I've been a little rude, my state president has pointed out, if you know, would you say something a little bit more about Jesus? Because I know that you have a testimony. Like, yes. but you can get that on LDS.org. You know, notwithstanding the critique, you know, at least in my neck of the woods, it's okay. You know, it's okay. You know, I'm not, you know, I do it because, and I think the people that I know that I do it because I love it. I love this church with just an unreasonable passion. And, you know, and I love my people with this, with just extraordinary amounts of kind of generosity, more generosity I think some people deserve. But, you know what I'm saying? You know, it's beautiful. It's beautiful being a Mormon. I love it.
Thank you. Well, loved it. That was a complete and wonderful surprise that you to go down this road. So thanks so much, Gina. We'll have you on again soon for one of our normal type of panel things.
Thanks, man.
That's our show this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you for all the great support that you give to Mormon Matters through your comments, through throwing your own ideas out there, even your critiques. And I especially love it, or I guess I should say especially, but I do love it and appreciate it so much when you go to the website and also donate to support the podcast, whether it's through a monthly subscription of $2, $5, $10 a month, whatever it would be, or just these one-time donations. There's buttons over at the website for both of those, and this is a big part of how things work in my life. So any support that you can give is just gratefully received, and I send out blessings to you through the cosmos every time I get a notification of something, and try to write you personally sometimes too. So thank you for that. I would also love feedback from anyone if this was a podcast that they especially liked, and if this should be something that we do occasionally, you know, every 4 or 5 months or something. Maybe I can get another group of people to do something like this about their favorite ideas. So I'd love feedback about whether this worked for you, or if you only want those panels on the big questions. So thanks, everybody. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
Enjoy.